Today on Maine Calling, spring gardening advice. No doubt, this weekend, greenhouses across the state will be busy with people itching to get their hands in the dirt. Even though it's a little early for many things, there are plenty of flowers and vegetables, think pansies and kale, you can plant right now. And besides, who doesn't love the smell of a greenhouse full of fresh seedlings and flowers? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, two horticulture experts join us with guidance for the garden. We'll touch on mulch, compost, weeds, watering, and spring strategies for your flower and vegetable beds. Also, we'll learn about the 30 new plants on the state's invasive species list and why that list was recently expanded. Get out the trowel. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. How does your garden look right now? What challenges are you grappling with? My guests today are ready to talk about the tasks and strategies to help your garden thrive this year and answer your questions. Joining me, Irene Barber, horticulture educator and horticulture therapist with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Gary Fish, state horticulturist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. Let us know about your gardening concerns and questions. Send an email, a pretty brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment to Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our gardening programs are very popular programs, so we recommend that you do not wait until the end to send your question or phone to call in to 1-800-399-3566. Irene, I'll start with you. It is May. This is the time of year when people are really, really ready to plant, and they can plant a few things right now, right? Pansies, kale, peas?
Yeah, definitely. As long as the plants have been hardened off, in particular, meaning that they've had a transitionary period from that indoor startup or indoor growing environment and getting outdoors, they need a little transition before you just release them to the exposures of Mother Nature. I was just planting some sweet alyssum and viola, Johnny Jump Ups, and starting to plant in some perennials as well. So everything from annuals to perennials, as well as our vegetables, we can start planting out there, just knowing that they are those that can tolerate these cooler night temperatures.
Okay, I'm going to turn the question around for you, Gary. What might we want to hold off on and not plant yet? Maybe not plant till June.
So things like tomatoes, cucumbers, you know, some of the summer type squashes and things like that. Anything that generally is not hardy this time of season. So you can put in your coal crops, but you can't put in your corn and your tomatoes and things like that.
Tomatoes are a big one for me. It's hard to hold off, but boy, it really does pay off if you wait, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let me talk about, we're in the month of May, and in years past, we've talked about this trend toward having something called no-mow Maine, and you'll see people who have really just kind of a field of a long grassy tangle in their yard and maybe a sign saying they're participating in no-mow May to help out the bees and the butterflies. Gary, do you advocate for that?
So there's some really good new research that's been done on no-mow May to show that it probably is not ideal. That it's better to go, if you want to increase the amount of flowers and the number of pollinators the ideal that's been found in Springfield, Massachusetts, was to mow every 2 weeks and continue that throughout the year. And that way you can encourage some of those low growing flowering plants that normally are in our lawns if you aren't using herbicides on a regular basis. And it also provides access to the tiny little bees that are looking for those flowers. When they went to a 3-week mowing schedule, they actually had more flowers, but fewer pollinators, because they think the pollinators couldn't find the flowers because the grass grew tall and overtopped those low-growing flowers. So no-mow May sounds like a great idea, but as more research is done on it, it's not necessarily going to be helping the pollinators that much. And when you go in and then try to scalp that all back, you're really hurting the lawn, the lawn grasses, as well as those flowering plants. It's not good to let them grow really tall and then knock them back.
And Irene, when we're talking about a lawn, maybe not having it all be grass, maybe some clover and some other things, right?
Yeah, certainly. Having a diversity of allowing broadleaf plants to come into your grassy green space. And what I was also going to mention to Gary's point is that we've also been concerned about when you don't mow in May, or if you mow at all and you try to extend a period of this nice long grass and then, or flowers, et cetera, and then you cut it, you're taking away a habitat that was starting to become the house or the homes of these beneficial insects. And it's not just pollinators, it's beneficial insects, it's bird nesting. So if you start to think that you're setting it up for success and then you take that habitat away, unfortunately, you kill off a lot as well.
Gary.
So one thing that I do is I just mow around the flowers that I know that want to be a little bit taller and just leave those in the lawn. And if you can tolerate that, I think it's a wonderful thing to do. And keep the grasses mowed, but allow some of the flowers to grow up and let them go to seed and start new flowers.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when we're talking about the diversity of the lawns, we're going to be considerate of those ground covers, like the bluets, the Houstonia, which is also the bluets are also known as Houstonia, or the clover. I have to say my breadth of all those broad leaves are probably including plants that a lot of people consider weeds. And really, weeds are just plants that are unknown. They're not understood, and they may not be where you intentionally had wanting them to grow. But ideally, it's great to try to see what will start to succeed or success in that lawn space if you can.
All right, Irene, I know that a lot of people right now are trying to prep their garden beds, want them to be in perfect condition, whether it's vegetable gardens or flower gardens. And a lot of people go out and procure lots of compost and spread it into their vegetable garden or into their perennial beds, especially people who are really interested in organic gardening. Tell us about compost. Are we supposed to lay an inch thick layer? Or I've heard recently, think of it as salt and pepper.
Yeah, you know, Jen, there is this magic term that we all use in horticulture. It depends. it's really
not just horticulture, by the way.
Yeah, okay, good. It really is a matter of what crop you or application you are laying the compost down for. You can lay it as an actual mulch. Mulch is only a term referring to a covering over the soil. So you can use compost material as a mulch, but there is such a thing as over-composting, and there's a concern where people refer to manure as compost, and that is not the same thing. So manure can be incorporated into compost, but it's certainly not the same thing. So if you have a really dense manure-based compost and you have too much of that rich material, it can actually counteract the growth that you had hoped to set up for. And a lot of our native plants, as you guys all know, we love talking about natives at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Native plants don't want rich compost. They want lean, duffy material to thrive in.
Gary.
Yeah, the other thing to think about with compost is, you know, ideally, especially if it's your vegetable garden, to have a good soil test and find out what are your organic matter levels to begin with, and then not overdoing it. You know, maybe if you have a really heavy clay soil, you might need a little bit more organic matter. But the other thing to think about is when you're importing things like compost, you have to think about what you might also be importing, like jumping worms. So just keep that in mind.
All right. Well, Gary, let's talk about something that's new, which is the updates to the Maine's invasive species list. This is a list that's reviewed periodically, and these are plants that you will not be able to find at your greenhouse. Tell us about the most recent update. I understand quite a few plants added.
Yes. So there were 30 new plants added to what we call the do not sell list. And these are plants that we have really done a lot of research on and vetted to find out that they truly are invasive in Maine, and we need to stop selling them. And I'm hoping that gardeners will understand and not try to find a way to get them or keep asking for them. You know, one of the more common ones that I think that people are struggling with right now is Callery pear. There are varieties called Bradford pear and Cleveland pear. And they are, you know, pretty trees, and unfortunately, they are extremely invasive, especially south of us. So we're trying to get ahead of the curve on this one, even though it's already been widely planted. We're hoping it's not going to get planted anymore. And there are other things out there. There's winter creeper euonymus is another one that in the past a lot of people have planted. And I just went for a walk yesterday down by the Kennebec River, and it's everywhere. It's spreading all over that area, just like many other invasive plants are down there, and it's getting quite a hold. And there are, you know, 30 new plants. They are, you can find out about them if you go to maine.gov/HORT, and you can go to the link for invasive plants. And, you know, basically starting this year, they're added to the already existing 33 plants. So we are banning 63 plants in the state of Maine. And if you want to know more, you know, definitely find out. And if you go to buy a plant and the garden center says, well, no, it's not available anymore, you know, please just think about what kind of native alternatives there might be for it. We've got lots of information on our website about what alternative plants will fit into the same kinds of places that those plants that we've banned. And just ask questions if you're concerned about it.
All right. And we will have in the Maine Calling newsletter a link to that list. Irene, let's follow up on what Gary said, and let's talk about some favorite potential natives, or at least non-invasive species that you would like to recommend people might want to incorporate into their garden. What are some beautiful plants and shrubs that people maybe haven't thought of over the years, but you think are a terrific choice?
Well, one thing that's blooming right now out in the landscape that's a shrub, and I've been looking at it for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks even, just in the bud stage, and it just keeps elongating and elongating. I'm like, when is it going to bloom? Is Amelanchier, also known as serviceberry or shadbush, and it has a number of species, but Amelanchier is the genus. And it is blooming right now. It has a beautiful, delicate, translucent red, coppery red foliage as the leaves are emerging, and the flowers are very dainty. But on the in the adjacent where you may see that growing is that composite of the invasive Callery pear, which, so it's important to see how they are growing in the same time frame, and one looks much more naturalized and one looks much more contrived. So which one are you going to go for? The more naturalized one in the native world. So we definitely want to encourage the Amelanchiers as much as possible. Another one is Aronia, also known as black chokeberry. In the Maine landscape, we have Melanocarpa, Aronia melanocarpa. And that one has a beautiful display of the white flowers just soon after the Amelanchiers. And they both, serviceberry and black chokeberry, have a beautiful fruit that is both edible to us and to wildlife. So those are two of my top favorites as far as shrubs. And I just want to put a plug into shrubs. We oftentimes forget about how valuable our shrub lands are, and they really are indicative of a Maine landscape rather than a lot of the herbaceous. We do have a good number of great native herbaceous, but our shrubs sometimes get forgotten.
All right. And Gary, what would you add to that?
Well, you know, elderberry is blooming or starting to bloom right now, too. So that's a great one to add into your landscape. It's great for pollinators as well as birds and for yourself if you want to make something out of the berries. And I don't know, you know, I think right now, I think you need to be looking at what's already in your yard. So for me, I've got a ton of asters that are starting to come up. And if you can learn to identify them early, then you can mow around them and allow them to grow in your landscape. And so there's a lot of things that may already be there. And, you know, I've talked about this before, the goldenrods too, if you can find those and mow around those are really essential for the pollinators later in the year.
I want to go, before we go to a break, I want to go to one call. We're going to go to Pam calling from Dedham. Hi, Pam, go ahead.
Hi, I have a rhubarb question. I have 6 or 7 plants, and I was so excited. They all came back. They were all looking great. I checked them every morning. I went out this morning, and every one of them has bolted.
Mm.
I broke them all off, but is there something I can do or something I did that made that happen? And what do I do to get them to continue growing and producing?
Gary, is that you?
No, I don't have a good answer for that. Irene
does.
Oh, no.
I will say, so I'm curious if you've had this ever happen before. Can you answer that?
No, it hasn't. I have had them bolt later in the season, but never this early.
Right. Well, I mean, one, I'm just curious about if there's any changes that have happened in the landscape recently, if you've had erosion accumulating and the soil getting denser and wetter over a period of time, if they've been getting oversaturated, that will oftentimes promote the plant to want to reproduce because it's in stress mode. Mm. And so a lot of plants, when they're in stress, they will go for flowering and then they send off their flowers, will end up going to seed, and then they send off their babies. So it's like an alert mechanism. So it could be that there was something that was either chewing the roots, perhaps even a rodent, perhaps, and it just it stimulated the plant to want to reproduce more hastily. But what I would do is, if that's the case, I would take up one of the plants, dig it out, divide it, and maybe fluff it up with what we were just talking about of that humusy material and maybe some compost so that it's a light compost. And so you're creating a little more permeability opportunity for the roots to thrive. And it will actually redevelop new basal leaves, and you'll have another stock of rhubarb leaves or stems to take advantage of rhubarb pie sometime.
Good luck, Pam. We are going to go to a break now. If you want to call 1-800-399-3566 and our email talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are tackling gardening questions today, including what to know about invasive plants, how to keep your garden healthy. We've talked about compost. We're going to talk about watering. With me, Gary Fish, Maine State Horticulturist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry, and Irene Barber, horticulture therapist and educator with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, and our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also find us in social media. Well, we are early in the program, and we already have 3 questions on the same topic from Karen, from Nancy, and Max. They all want to know how to get rid of moss on the lawn. Max writes, I feel like moss is taking over my whole front yard and backyard. Karen says, I have had unrelenting moss growth in almost all my gardens. Okay. Irene, you're smiling. You like moss.
Yes. Unfortunately, both Gary and I love moss, so we're not going to tell people to remove moss. I hope you don't mind, Gary. I'm speaking for you because we both see eye to eye on this one. It is, it's a reaction to what the conditions are in your landscape. And if you alter your landscape, you are going to incorporate more inputs, more maintenance, more money, things that are just going to be somewhat really out of your control unless you really need to make this a grassy experience. But I think it's important that people also appreciate the low maintenance aspect. Everyone wants low maintenance. So hey, guess what? Moss is low maintenance and it's a wonderful living ground cover. It is a situation though, if it is starting to overwhelm some of your desirable perennials, then it is an indication of a lot of water, major compaction, and a lot of shade. So if you can maybe bounce limit the amount of water or reduce the amount of compaction, then you will start to preventively manage your moss. But try not to use any chemicals, please, and embrace the moss as much as possible.
So I'm going to ask you, when you say about the compaction, are you talking about doing some sort of aeration in your lawn? And as far as sun, maybe removing some boughs from some trees?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to promote too much havoc on our trees just because our trees already are in such distress from what we've experienced this winter from all of our storms. But if it is an opportunity where you have some crossing branches or damaged branches and you want to alleviate those from the canopy, then certainly go for it. And that may hopefully open up some tunnels of light. But when I talk about compaction, I'm also referring to adding gypsum in the soil or some of that leaf detritus or leaf mold into the soil and incorporating it, not just aerating. Aerating is only going to do so much. So it's really plugging up those holes with material that's going to incorporate, which will increase porosity. And that's what we're going for.
All right, Gary, we've stated that both you and Irene like moss, say embrace the moss, but I'm going to push back a little bit. Somebody has moss right now in the spring when it's been rainy and cool in July and August, that may turn brown and not be so attractive.
Yeah, yes and no. I have a almost 100% moss lawn at my camp on Flying Pond, and it's fine. Even in the summer, it looks okay. But if you really hate moss and you want to do something about it, you have to do a lot of work because moss grows where other plants don't like to grow. And it can take advantage of those poor growing conditions where other plants are not going to thrive there. So you can't, even if you go and buy a product to try to control it, it's not going to help because unless you change the growing conditions, moss is going to come back and you're just beating your head against the wall. You know, basically do need to change the soil, change the light aspect, and change the amount of water that's happening. And, you know, last year we had so much rain, so it's not surprising that moss took advantage of that. But it's really the other conditions that are causing those problems. And, you know, moss is supposed to be golden. There's a lot of mosses that are more golden than they are green.
I like that word, golden. Go ahead, Irene, not tan or brown, golden. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I have my moss looking very chartreuse right now. Yellow, golden, more chartreuse. It's predominantly a sphagnum moss. But one thing I just want to add is if you're really concerned about it, really just send our favorite thing that we also like to recommend on these radio shows is send a soil sample to the Cooperative Extension and understand the pH and the nutrients in your soil. And if you do want to make some alterations, do it only when you have sent that soil sample in and have gotten results to tell you what you need to do to mitigate the situation.
All right. So many questions coming in, mainly emails here. Here's from Lindsay. Is there a native shrub that works well to create a privacy hedge? I'm considering elderberry, but wonder if there's a better option. I'm located in Orono. Let's see. Irene, I see you nodding. What would you plant for a privacy hedge?
Well, okay. So for that person's question, I would say Northern Bayberry for really drought tolerant environments. If it's a well fertile soil and doesn't have any salt spray, then yes, bayberry is, I mean, excuse me, elderberry is great, but elderberry gets 10 to 15 feet tall. So you need to have the space for that. Another one could be gray odor dogwood or red twig dogwood. And I was even mentioning aronia earlier. We use aronia here like it's going out of style at the gardens. So we use it incessantly. So definitely check that one. Sorry. And it's also known as black chokeberry for those of you who like common names. I apologize.
All right. And so I'm going to go on because we have so many questions coming in. Here's an email from Winifred. Is blue spruce considered native to the Northeast? If not, is it detrimental or invasive to northern Maine? I love the look, but I don't want to do any harm. Gary.
So blue spruce is not native to the Northeast. At this point, we haven't found it to be a big invader. I think that it could be invasive in some places, but probably not so much in Maine. And there are plenty of beautiful spruces that you can use. There's white and red spruce that you can get that are native to Maine. Red spruce has a little bit shorter needles and will, you know, really tolerate shady areas. White spruce has longer needles and has a little bit of a funny smell to it. People call it cat spruce because of what it smells like, but you don't necessarily notice that in the landscape. It's more if you happen to cut it for a Christmas tree and then you notice it. But those are, you know, perfectly good spruces to use. The other thing about blue spruce is that it does have a tendency to get something that's called Cooley spruce gall adelgid on it that can be an interesting insect problem. And, you know, but it's not native, not to Maine.
All right. We're going to go to Susan, who is asking about invasives. She says, I've been able to keep the invasive weeds to a minimum in my garden, pulling monk's weed and cutting back multiflora roses, and then in all caps, until this year. The monk's weed have taken over the garden bed and are showing up in the front lawn. I'm resigned to losing the garden bed and considering options for a container garden. Other than using an excavator, can I reduce or contain the monk's weed and multiflora roses, prevent it from traveling across the lawn and to the adjacent garden beds? Oh boy, Susan's speaking for a lot of people. We'll start with Irene. I'll have you all both answer this.
So I do apologize. I've never heard of monk's weed. There could be gout weed, perhaps, is what, which is also known as bishop's weed. And maybe that's what the person is asking. Honestly, suppressing these as much as possible. The gout weed is a ground cover. Trying to make sure that it does not flower or go to seed at least. And then as far as the multiflora rose, same thing. You cannot let these things go to flower or go to seed, I should say. And that's the number one management means of preventing these from spreading throughout the property. But suppressing them and cutting them back repeatedly without using chemicals as much as you possibly can is how I suggest it to people.
All right, and Gary, I'm going to add to that because a friend of mine has asked me to ask you about bishop's weed. This person is trying to, what he says, worry it to death. Every time he sees some, just snip, snip, snip. But he's wondering if that's really just a lost cause.
So I think what she was referring to as monk's weed is probably bishop's weed. And it's a very deep-rooted perennial plant, and it is very difficult to manage because of that. You can mow and mow and mow, and it'll take a very long time to exhaust all the built-up energy that's in the root system. As Irene said, you don't want it to go to flower, even though in flower, it's a great pollinator plant, actually. It gets mobbed by lots of pollinators, but it is very invasive. It's not legal to sell in the state. It's on our list, our do not sell list. And ideally, I think that we need to be less concerned about using herbicides for invasive plants. This is one, bishop's weed, that is almost impossible to manage without them. Same thing goes for multiflora rose. It's a very deep-rooted woody plant, very hard to control. If you have a big stump or something like that, you can treat it with just a tiny dab of herbicide on the stump and it will kill the plant. The problem she's going to have is there's probably a buildup of all kinds of seed bank that's already in her area where birds have been, planting those seeds for a long time. And the other thing that you can do, which is extreme and does have a lot of impacts on the soil and soil organisms, is to cover it over, you know, to cover it over with multiple layers of mulch and cardboard or, you know, other materials and completely block the light. And you have to basically go probably another 3 feet beyond where the infestation is, because oftentimes they're able to find their way through rhizome growth around that cover. But keep in mind that even doing that has a lot of impacts on the soil and soil organisms.
I'm going to go to Stephanie calling from Sanford. Hi, Stephanie, go ahead.
Hi, we have a plant, I believe it's called fleabane. They're little tiny white daisies that they're really pretty, but they're all over the yard and I can't seem to get it under control. So just looking for some advice.
All right, Irene, we're kind of on a theme here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a client who loves fleabane, so you can give it to him if you want. I'll give you his address. but it is a daisy that is beautiful, and that's why people generally keep it, and then they wish they hadn't, because it just reproduced readily everywhere. Ideally, if you want to, it's really easy to pull out. It has a very easy root system to pull out. So if you can do that now while things are emerging, then you're going to set yourself up for a much better stage for you to plant in the desirables. The thing is, a lot of what we call undesirables or weeds are growing there because nothing else has been put into the place, or the setup is not conducive for perhaps some of our native plants that have been, you know, distressed. So if we can set the stage up for the desirable plants, put them in as soon as possible. Make sure there is no vacancy as soon as you can. Once you've pulled something out, put something back into its place. So that would be my number one suggestion. If you have a huge 10 by 10 area and they're just coated, then again, just cut them back and keep cutting them back. So you cut down the photosynthesizing ability, which ensures it to overwinter. But if you keep cutting them back, then they will not overwinter for the following year.
Good luck, Stephanie. An email here from Janet. I've had voles tunnel under most plants and shrubs. Their tunnels are everywhere. I wonder about root and long-term damage. The jumping worms are already out and about. Have they taken the place of regular earthworms? I've noticed a lot of crumbly soil, which I think I read can be attributed to this invasive critter. Also noticing more moss and ferns attributed to the acidification of our soils. Okay, that's a lot. Gary, I'll toss to you. Let's talk about voles and jumping worms.
Well, voles are going to be around. If you live near the forest, they're going to come into your landscape, and they do feed on roots. They feed on plants. They're different from moles, who feed on earthworms and grubs and things like that. And if you provide them a lot of cover around your garden, or if you have a lot of snow build up, that's going to be the areas probably where they're going to do the most damage. They can be really damaging to fruit trees and junipers and other plants, that they'll basically chew the bark off and girdle stems and cause severe damage that way. And they'll often eat flower bulbs and things like that. In terms of trying to manage them, again, really all you can do is not provide them with cover. You can encourage other wildlife to eat them. You can do some trapping, although they're very difficult to trap. I wouldn't use any kind of rodenticide for them, although orchards do, but I don't think that a homeowner should be doing that. And then the jumping worm side of things, certainly they are coming out now. They're hard to identify right now because they're immature, so they don't have their clitellum. So it's hard to differentiate them from the other worms. The only way to do it when they're in their immature stage is to look at the little setae or hairs that are on them that are distributed all the way around the worm on a Amenthes worm or jumping worm, and on our European earthworms, they're just in pairs that are kind of not all that many pairs around the worm. And, you know, it's that soil signature is definitely part of it. If you see that real coffee ground, crumbly soil, that may be an indicator, may or may not. They have been shown to kind of exclude European earthworms in some places, although I think we need a lot more research on that to know for sure. They usually stay in the top 2 inches of soil and the duff that's there. So they don't go down really deep like night crawlers and probably don't have a lot of impact on those.
All right.
I don't remember the rest.
Yeah. And I want to follow up on this conversation about worms. And I'll turn to you, Irene. Somebody here, boy, there's so many questions. Oh, here we go. Lorna says, I have a low area in my yard that could use some fill. I'm concerned if I buy compost or dirt, I could be introducing jumping worms. Is there a safe way to add dirt without the jumping worms?
Sure. Well, okay. So I will start. It's soil or compost, no dirt. We're not incorporating dirt. Dirt is not good. So I'm going to pick on that person only because I love hearing soil. So that is a quandary for all of us in the horticulture trade right now, is understanding our sources of soils. And ideally, instead of importing any soils, what you'll want to do is bring in a lasagna layering opportunity. So bringing in material that you have on your property. If you are in an urban area and you don't even have really organics around you, then I would recommend getting some of the bagged material for a small area, if it is a small area, because the bagged compost will be most likely less concerning for worms, jumping worms to be already incorporated in it. But unfortunately, a lot of our composts, you know, the worms are going towards organic material. They want that material. So if you are bringing in compost from somewhere, most likely there's going to be all the kinds of worms in there. So it's no longer, I remember even listening to Gary about this, it's no longer preventing, it's managing at this stage in game. So we definitely need to be thoughtful and monitoring, but don't just rid your soils of organic material, just perhaps buff it up in certain areas, and then you consolidate their habitat of where those worms are going to reside.
And before we go to a break, which we need to do, I just want to ask really quickly, let's say you've purchased some compost and maybe you don't need much. Maybe you have a couple raised beds. So you go to your local nursery or hardware store and you buy a bag or two of compost. Is there a way to check it before you put it in the garden and make sure that it's okay? Is there something
no.
to look for? No. Oh, okay.
No.
Thanks.
So
all right.
if there are cocoons that have the eggs in there, you're not going to be able to tell because they look like grains of soil.
Okay, well, we're going to take another quick break. So many questions coming in. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, or send an email, brief email, to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. And today, our ever popular gardening show, we do about 4 per season. This is our May show. My guest today, Gary Fish, state horticulturist, and Irene Barber with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Or if you're really quick, you can post on Facebook or Instagram. So many questions coming in, but I want to just say we have an email from Seth who says, we were finally able to eradicate our massive areas of Bishop's weed with weekly mowing. Takes a full season. Weekly mowing was also a solution for Japanese knotweed. The trick is to get the whole patch and to be relentless. So, okay, thanks for that advice. An email here from Lee. Has anyone mentioned grapevines yet? They have invaded our orchard and are very difficult to remove. Any advice appreciated? Grapevines. I'll turn to you, Irene.
So most likely those are fox grapes and those are endemic. So I don't know that the term invasive, they will colonize as long as the space allows it. Back to the previous person who said about cutting and mowing. Well, if you keep cutting them back, it will stunt them over time. I would try to encourage some, they're seeking light. That's the idea. So they're on the edge of a forest and they're seeking light. So if you want to overshadow them and plant some more canopy in front of them, then that will just, you know, diminish their desirability coming forward too much more. But that's in turn what they're trying to do. So they will root on the ground. So if you can prevent them from rooting on the ground, then you will also stop them from spreading.
Okay, Gary, I'm going to give you our last weed question of the hour, but it's a doozy. Robin on Facebook, is there any way to eradicate the horsetail weed? This is the one that's prehistoric, right?
Yeah, so horsetail is a native plant. It's being spread around by mulches. A lot of people purchase mulch and it has the spores in the mulch and it will grow. It is one that's very difficult to manage. Sometimes adding nitrogen can help because it will encourage other plants to grow and discourages the horsetail from growing. There is a good a fact sheet on the horsetail, I think, on the gutpests.org website that they could go and look at that will give them some tips. It is one that no matter how much you mow it or remove it or pull it, it just seems to keep coming back. And, you know, you really do have to kind of change the growing conditions in order to get that plant to be overwhelmed by other plants. It really has to be overwhelmed by other plants.
All right. And I know that it's the bane of so many gardeners. I have a couple questions here about mulch, and I know this is a big topic for you, Irene, so I'm going to turn to that. Let's see here. Let me see if I can find this. We're going to start with Jen's. Jen writes, I have access to a lot of wood shavings from woodworker friends, and I'd like to use it as mulch. The wood was untreated, but I think there are concerns with wood shavings related to airflow and nutrient depletion. What kind of plants can be mulched with wood shavings?
So my husband is a furniture maker, woodworker, so I have lots of wood shavings as well. And we use it for paths. We ideally like to use it for the path construction. I only use wood shavings when they have been out in the pile for almost 2 years, and then I will use them for a mulch. They do have a lot of carbon still. And so I just don't want to incorporate that carbon into the soil because it can start to bind up other nutrients. So again, another aspect of knowing your pH, or excuse me, your nutrient from a soil test as well, to know maybe you do have low carbon, but most of the time people don't. Then as you pile up the wood shavings, believe it or not, it becomes a carbon sequestering opportunity. So it becomes an environmental benefit if you do have piles of it aging in place. So that would be my recommendation, is accumulate them, but then don't use them until they've aged for about 2 years, just like regular wood chips in that case.
Okay. Okay. And I want to ask you just generally, Irene, about mulch. I understand that some of the mulch out there, the black mulch, isn't really even all natural.
Yeah, they use a food coloring dye in them. I hope it's only food coloring. I never know if it's more than that. Maybe Gary knows a little more insight on that. But I regularly recommend aged, decomposed, mixed material mulch, like mixed wood, like it's spruce, it's pine, it's hemlock. And if they want to just go with the wood mulch, that looks clean to people. I personally love mixing compost into my mulch, and sometimes that's just leaf mold and pine needles, and they've all aged, and then I just use those as my mulches. Then another thing that I just use is straight leaf mold or aged leaves, and shred them or just let them accumulate, and then I till them around and break them up in that case. But mulches can be... we add too much mulch. I know that there are lots of photos out there in the world of volcano mulching. Please, no more volcano mulching. We really need to see the flares of tree trunks and not see these little popsicle sticks. So there is such a thing as way too much mulching. I actually only do 1 inch of mulch a year.
I'm going to interrupt you and just say that for those people who don't know what volcano mulching is, it's, and you see this often around, you know, sort of shopping areas and things like that, but also in people's yards, when people pile up a mulch, maybe in a circle around a base of a tree. And this is what Irene is saying, please, please, please don't do it. It's not good for the tree, right?
Yeah, I mean, when it becomes like it's actual volcano, yes, correct. You can certainly put mulch around the root system or that pretty little circle around the tree trunk. Just don't cover over the flare, please.
All right. Steve wants to know about innovative strategies short of a hoop house for reducing tomato blight. And he says, emphasis on innovative. Gary, do you grow tomatoes? And what do you do to avoid blight?
Well, tomato blight, one way to reduce it is to not irrigate overhead. So don't keep adding water to those leaves and the splashing from the ground. So water those plants at the base. And ideally do that with all your garden plants if you can. It's much better to use a soaker hose or use a drip irrigation system, because every time that you splash up the soil onto the bottom of those leaves, that's bringing potential spores up into those plants. And fungal diseases like late blight or early blight are going to be exacerbated by continuing to allow the leaf to be wet. The other thing is to space your plants appropriately so that you've got good air circulation around the plants. You can also remove the lower leaves as the plant grows, and because those can be the first to become infected because they are getting that splash back from the ground. So I think the other thing to think about is looking for disease-resistant varieties. So when you go to purchase the plants that you want to put in, that you're looking, doing the research to find out, is that particular variety resistant to either late blight or early blight, whichever one you're having a problem with. And then the other thing is to make sure that's what it is. So if you take a sample and bring that to the cooperative extension or send it into the disease diagnostic lab, Allison can take a look at that and let you know if that's really what the problem is.
All right. Try to get a couple more questions in here. This is from Paul. Paul writes, I have a large garbage can of combined wood stove and charcoal ashes. Can I add them to my vegetable garden soil? And if so, how much? Regarding the remainder of the ashes, can I simply dig a hole in my backyard and safely bury them? Irene.
I'm actually going to do just that. I am going to take some of my wood pile burnt. It almost looks like biochar at this point because it's not fully broken down. And I'm going to add that into my garden soil because I have a high pH in my garden soil. So this will help kind of lower the pH and also release nutrients and water at a slower rate. The benefit of the material that's even further broken down or burned up, I should say, is that you can use that for a pH stabilizer so that it will raise pH around some of your alkaline loving plants. So you could certainly incorporate it. It will not be available right off the bat. It takes a while. So you won't see drastic differences in one growing season.
All right. Well, we just have about a minute left. And Gary, I know that you want to talk about being careful out there, that there are some real considerations that are serious in Maine today that were not the case 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's really important that gardeners protect themselves when they're out gardening these days, especially from deer ticks, which can transmit multiple diseases, not just Lyme disease, but anaplasmosis and babesiosis. And also, if you're in an area where there are brown tail moth, they are now starting to shed their skins and the hairs are going to start accumulating. And those urticaceous hairs have a little bit of a chemical that when they stick into your skin, it causes a rash for most people. I may actually have a little bit of it myself right now. So it's really important to have good coverage of your skin while you're out there. To tuck your socks, or tuck your pants into your socks, wear light colored clothing so you can see those ticks creeping up on you, and make sure that at the end of the day, you're always doing a really thorough tick check and taking a shower at the right after you get done gardening, and making sure you also take your clothes and kind of beat them and get the ticks out of the clothes before you put them in the hamper. There's lots of different strategies that you can use. Take a cool shower. If you're in a situation where there might be brown tail moth hairs, you want to come in and take a cool shower, not a hot shower, because that can actually cause the rash to be worse. So just keep that in mind, and you can learn a lot more about all of those things either at the Maine CDC about ticks, at the Maine Forest Service about brown tail moth.
All right. Well, thank you both for your time. That was Gary Fish, state horticulturist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, and Irene Barber, a horticulture therapist and educator with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandrow. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I mentioned the Maine Calling newsletter. You can sign up for that by going to mainecalling.org. It is free. It talks about links from that week's show, and it tells you about shows coming up. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.